Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:41 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 29th, and it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And of course, it's also the last one of the year. So happy new year to all of our subscribers. It's certainly been an eventful year, and we're looking forward to providing you with the best possible service that we can over the course of the rest of this secular bull market. And this is an important consideration, that we are in a secular bull market and that it will obviously eventually be punctuated by the occasional recession, but that those will represent buying opportunities from the perspective of a long-term investor. What I thought I would do today is to really focus on long-term charts, and rather than focus on just the intraday short term or the just multi-week or multi-month moves, but really think more about very long-term themes. And one of the most consistent trends in the world has been the total return on bonds since the early 1980s. And I'm showing it here on a logarithmic scale chart. So one did really very well in bonds in the 80s. If you were buying bonds on a total return basis in the early 1980s, you were getting whopping yields. In an environment where you were where we were entering a period of disinflation, where inflation was starting to come down from extraordinarily high levels, what that represented was a boon for anyone who was investing in fixed income, because they were locking in these very high yields, and then inflation was coming in way below what those yields were. And that persisted for a pretty significant amount of time, all the way through until the late 1990s. You were still doing really well out of bonds. And you can see that the index went from approximately 90 at the beginning of 1982 to approximately 700 by the end of 1999. So that was a very meaningful advance. But since then, it has gone up a lot since then. It's gone up an additional 200%. But obviously that it does not compare with a move from 90 to 700. And then if we look at the period from about 2010 onwards, then the index has gone up approximately 100 points. So there has been a considerable loss of momentum. And what, of course, this also helps to represent is the diminishing return that you get from quantitative easing. The more money that you put in, the more that you have to put in order to get the same result. And what we also see is that if we just contrast this performance in the total return of bonds with the total amount of money that is sitting on the balance sheets of central banks, then we get pretty close correlations that this trend has gone from the left, the lower left, to the upper right in no uncertain terms. It's gone from approximately, and we do not have nearly the same length of history of data for this particular chart. It only goes back as far as 2002. We can't go any further back than that. But what we do know is that all the way back here, it was around $2.9, $2.8 trillion in 2002, and it's closer to 20 today. So, in fact, it is 20 on the on this chart right now. And this is significant. It is a big milestone on the last trading day of the year that central bank balance sheets hit the big psychological $20 trillion level. And this wall of money that has been poured into asset markets has obviously had a considerable effect on asset prices. That when we look at property prices, they are back at or above the pre-credit crisis levels in the USA and in the UK. They are considerably above those levels in places like Australia and Canada. That just in the last month, we have seen a Da Vinci, or at least a painting that has been ascribed to Da Vinci with questionable covenants, has sold for $450 billion. Excuse me, million dollars. There's a lot of money flashing around. So what's a zero between friends? But no, it's a $450 million. That's an exceptional sum. That would have been unimaginable a decade ago. Then, of course, we've seen a significant advance in stock markets, and most particularly in markets where we've had the majority of this quantitative easing. So, for example, the S&P 500 has gone from 666 to 2,684 in the space from early 2009 until the end of 2017. And certainly, we can see on this chart that the pace of the advance has really picked up in the last year. So, it is. I think it's often a mistake to ascribe when you look at charts like this to say that they're accelerating on a very long-term basis. Certainly, the pace has picked up, but the advance that we've had in the last year has been really quite consistent. So, let's look at it on a logarithmic scale chart. And if we do that, then we can see that this has been a really quite an impressive advance. But what is perhaps more important is that if we look at it from a very long-term perspective, that the S&P 500 has tended to experience lengthy periods where it goes sideways and then lengthy periods where it advances. And those lengthy periods where it goes sideways, and we've seen these, that they have tended to last for decades. That there was a major peak in 1929, and it was all the way through until 1954 before that peak was taken out. Then we had a significant peak in 1965, and then it was an awfully long time. It was the 1980s before that peak was surmounted on a sustained basis. And then we had a major peak in 1999, early 2000, and that peak was taken out in 2013. So, in fact, this consolidation, this very volatile range, punctuated by two bear markets of epic proportions, well, that was one of the shorter periods of consolidation in the context of this cyclical environment where you get secular bull and bear markets, where the cyclical, excuse me, the secular bull markets have generally been anything in the region of 10 to 20 years when you get the breakout. And if the breakout was in 2013 and we're at the end of 2017, well, this one is only 4 years in the making. So that is why I continue to believe that we are in the early stages of a secular bull market. But at the same time, we are probably in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market. So secular is very long term, and cyclical is less long term. It's more medium term. And the animating force behind this medium term bull market, which has seen asset prices improve really quite considerably, has been central bank largesse. Now, we know where all of that is coming from. We know that the Federal Reserve has been adding a great deal of money, but when we look at the size of their balance sheet, it stopped going up in 2014, and it is ever so slowly starting to deteriorate once more. Then, if we look at the ECB's balance sheet, well, it doubled in the last few years, and it is still increasing. So if we were to look at, well, central bank balance sheets are at 20 trillion euros. It's not that additional money that we've seen come in over the last 3 years has not come from the Federal Reserve, but it has come from the ECB, where they've added over 2.4 trillion euro to the size of their balance sheet. And of course, that central bank balance sheet chart is dollar denominated, so then this is even more. And they're not quite done yet. They're going to start tapering in January, but they won't be done with adding additional capital to their balance sheet until September of next year. Now, there is another aspect to all of this that is worth bearing in mind, and that is that we're going to have a new Federal Reserve chair in the first quarter of next year, and there'll be a new head of the ECB in early 2019. And if we cast our minds back to when Mario Draghi was appointed, then the deal was that the next ECB head would be a German. So the ECB contracted the size of its balance sheet by approximately €1 trillion between 2012 and 2014 and created deflation. And they were in such dire straits that they had to reverse course. They had to take their foot off the neck of the peripheral nations and ease up on the fiscal consolidation that was going on. So they had to loosen up in order to get growth moving again. And growth is improving in Europe. The fact that Europe is back to a growth footing is one of the primary constituents behind this period of synchronized global economic expansion that we're currently enjoying. Then, when we look at Japan, well, the Bank of Japan's balance sheet has continued to expand, and when we look at that in terms of the its contribution to the overall advance, well, the size of this balance sheet has multiplied since 2013, and we can see that the pace of the advance has moderated, but it is continuing to go higher. And Japan is one of the only countries that is still running both f loose fiscal and monetary policy. So that is, I think, rather important. Whereas what China is doing is in large part now neutral, because they are leaning on the shadow banking sector. And that's rather difficult to monitor from the perspective of the stock market, because so many of the financial institutions that have been engaged in this shadow banking are not listed. They tend to be the regional banks and rather small, whereas it is the major indices are very much dominated by the very large banks. Now, if we look at the Chinese stock market, I think if over the last 15 years, it has been punctuated by these whopping advances from time to time. But again, what this is representative of is an evolving regulatory environment, that this index is he very heavily weighted by banks and infrastructure, and that isn't necessarily representative where the growth is coming from in the Chinese economy. That China has gone through this incredible evolution in terms of the development of a consumer class. They set it as one of their 5-year targets about half a decade ago, and they've hit it. That the Chinese consumer is now a global force, and that what we're starting to see is that this is a very important constituent to consumer demand globally. That over the last 30 or 40 odd years, it has been the US consumer has been the primary driver of consumption globally. And the evolution of a consumer class in China, which now represents approximately 64% of GDP, is a very meaningful evolution. What it really helps to drive home is that there is no simple way of looking at a country the size of China, and that and most particularly when we look at the stock market, that it does not give us a true reflection of what's going on within the economy, and not least because so many of the really important companies from the consumer perspective are not listed in China. Therefore, what we should be doing is perhaps looking at the currency. And if we look at the renminbi over the course of the last 30 odd years, then it had a meaningful devaluation in 1993, and it pretty much unwound most of that by the beginning of 2014. Then it went through a period of weakening, and now we have had a significant strengthening through the second half of 2017. And if we zoom in and just look at what's been going on recently, then the renminbi has been strengthening up. What they are trying to do is to restrict access to credit, that they are trying to handle their debt problems, and part of what all of that is helping to stem outflows from the mainland, and that is helping to steady up the currency. And this is rather significant, because when we look at that on a weekly basis, the renminbi could quite easily have pushed back up above the trend mean when it weakened again, or excuse me, the dollar could have pushed back up above the trend mean when it strengthened again from the end of the third quarter. But now the renminbi has found support there, and we're seeing the dollar pulling back again. So what this suggests is that 7 renminbi represents a key area of support, and 6 is probably a key area of resistance, and the currency could be ranging between those levels for a fairly significant period of time. Now, when we think about where are we in terms of this cycle, then this still remains a very bullish environment, because we're still in a period of synchronized global economic expansion. And we might be in the latter stages of a cyclical medium-term bull, but that it's not over. I think that is by far the most important characteristic. In fact, I think it is important to identify what the leading market is in this environment. And the leading market is the NASDAQ 100. What the NASDAQ has done it has taken out its bubble peak from all the way back in 1999. And that has been a significant achievement this year. And the pace of this advance is picking up, but there is no indication that it is over. We had some pause of consolidation between about 2014 and early 2016 in the region of the previous peak, and now the advance has been reasserted on the upside, and the outperformance of major technology companies that are increasingly dominating this particular index, most notably the FANGs, is still very much intact. That Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon are really helping to dominate this index, and they are dominating their respective niches as well. What we have seen so far in 2017 has been catch-up, that emerging markets are beginning to benefit both from the long-tail effect of this extraordinary monetary policy, which has helped to inflate asset prices in domestic markets where it was initiated first and then has flowed out to the rest of the world. Again, that's a very clear example of the fact that capital is both mobile and global. So what we've begun to see is that an increasingly large number of markets are breaking up and out of very long-term ranges. And I really do want to show these very long-term ranges. So Taiwan has been ranging since 1990, and the index broke above 10,000 this year. The Korean market did something similar. It ranged from, well, it hit an important peak around 2000 in 2008. It briefly surmounted that in 2011, then went sideways for the next 6 years, and then broke out. So again, this is evidence of markets playing catch up. The Indonesian market was one of the first to bottom in late 2008, and then it broke out in the last couple of months, and it is continuing to extend that advance. Then when we look at the Indian market, India is going through really quite an impressive economic revolution, that they have introduced 4G in the last year. They have completed collecting biometric data from 1.3 billion people in just the last year. What that is doing is it is going to allow the administration and the economy to grow and to meet its long-term goals. That there is ample potential here for India to outperform over the significant long term. Let me demur for a moment from looking at the stock market and simply to look at the currency market. It's not an exaggeration to think that the Indian rupee only goes down. Now, when you look at it all the way from the early 1970s until quite recently, you could think that it probably only goes down. But what we really should do is look at that on a really long-term logarithmic scale chart. And when we look at it on that basis, then what's happened in the last year is very meaningful. Because what we now have evidence of is a base forming that we had a rally at the right here in the beginning of April of this year, which broke this progression of lower rally highs evidence since 2011. Now we've had a first step above the base, and there is the potential that the rupee could be breaking higher sometime next year. Well, that would represent really quite a profound change, because one of the reasons that the Indian rupee had gone down pretty much since independence was because of inflation. That inflation was not possible to keep under control. But with improving governance and with improving statistical analysis, statistical data, and the introduction of online banking, then what online banking more than any other factor does is remove the influence of cash on the economy. That is something else that we've seen in China as well. That when I was in China in July, that was one of the standout things that really stood out to us was that previously on every other trip that we had to carry a lot of cash because you just simply couldn't transact without it. Whereas it was almost the opposite this time, that people were unwilling to take cash, that you had to pay for everything with Alipay or WeChat Pay. And it makes the consumer experience absolutely seamless. But what it also does for the government is gives the ability for monetary policy setters to analyze exactly what's going on in the economy. They have overview of every single transaction. It takes cash out of the back room under table and brings it into the conventional economy. And for a country like India, that is a profound change because what that will do is increase tax collection. It will increase tax compliance, and that it will also give millions of new people access to banking. And with banking, you get credit, and with credit, you can develop businesses. And that is something that is probably going to drive the secular bull market in India for the significant medium to long term. That India is a country where the growth of the economy is very well reflected in the stock market. There are very few Indian companies that are listed abroad that are not also listed on their domestic market. By buying the stock market, what you are doing is buying India. Whereas when you buy the Chinese stock market, what you're mostly buying is Chinese banks. And that is really quite a key difference, that one really does have to tailor one's strategy to the reality provided by the market. Now, if we continue to look at some of these very long-term charts, then in nominal terms, the South African stock market has broken upwards in just the last few weeks, and then found support in the last 2 weeks. Following Ramaphosa's victory in ousting Zuma. And when we look at this in nominal terms, there has been a clear upward bias. But again, it is in the currency that we probably get a much more, I think, important perspective. Because as recently as January of 2016, the rand was at a new all-time low, and we've had a significant strengthening, and it has strengthened pretty significantly over the last 2 weeks on Ramaphosa's victory. There is the potential that if it can hold on to this advance, that we could see additional strength coming through in the rand, and that would be a signal that the international community has got some faith that that governance is improving, and perceptions of both economic and political governance in South Africa have been at a particularly low ebb for the last few years. So an improvement there could lead to really quite a significant re-rating of the country. But obviously, there really is a lot to do in terms of what can be done for South Africa, because things have really got to pretty dire conditions. When we look at the European markets, then it's a pretty similar story in terms of the catch-up that that we're getting. So, for example, the FTSE 100 moved to a new all-time high in here this week, and we really should look at this on about with about as much history as we possibly can, because unfortunately, the FTSE 100 doesn't go back beyond beyond 1983. So we need to look at the all share, and I believe the ticker for that is the ASX. And when we look at that, well, what we can see is that there was a phenomenal bull market from that rather accelerated decline in the mid 1970s, and then the market has gone sideways pretty much since 2000, and it has really only just broken out this year. So that's a 17-year range. And I remember at the chart seminar a few years ago, there was a lady came along and said, "Look, I bought the FTSE back in 1998, and I've held it for the last 15 years, and I've got nothing to show for it, but my property has done much better." Well, property has been the go-to asset in the UK now for really quite a considerable period of time, because the price of property has done nothing but go up. But the stamp duty has risen considerably, and something that stood out to me while walking around London just in November was that the skyline is peppered with cranes, so there is a lot of building going on. That walking around East London, and I had to go to a meeting in Tower Hamlets. I remember when I first got to Tower Hamlets in the year 2000, that one of my cousins was doing volunteer work in the Muslim community there, and I went with him to visit, families that were three families to a small flat in Tower Hamlets, and the area has been gentrified. That there are large, modern, attractive apartments going in Tower Hill that would have been absolutely inconceivable 15 years ago. And this represents a really quite a considerable provision of additional housing for London. And one of the, I think, supply and demand are always going to be in any market, but when we look at the stock market and the fact that it is just breaking out, and then perhaps look at property prices. So when we look at, for example, the UK National Home Price Index, and look at that on a long-term logarithmic scale chart. Well, we know, without really looking at it, that it's been going up for a long time. And we also know that it is occasionally punctuated by these lengthy periods where it goes sideways. So house prices broke out to new highs back in 2014, and they are still going upwards. And this has been updated last on September 30th. but stocks have only just begun to go upwards. Now, I personally think that there is the potential for stocks to outperform the property market over the next decade, not least because the FTSE is leveraged to the growth of the global economy, and the FTSE 350 is perhaps more internationally and then also domestically arranged, and it is also pushing on to new high ground. And I think these are significant because when one looks at what the majority of media commentary has been on Brexit and on the UK, it has been downright gloomy. But an important consideration is that the pound has weakened considerably, and the pound has pretty much stopped going down. So if the pound has stopped going down, then what that does is it begins to allow investors to begin to think about potentially putting some money back into the country, because if the currency has stopped going down, then you don't have quite the same currency risk. If India can benefit from the end of the rupee's deterioration, there is absolutely no reason why the UK can't also benefit from the end of the pound's deterioration. There are significant challenges that are still posing for the EU, because I think that it is increasingly likely that countries like France and Germany, Italy, Spain, and the rest of the periphery are going to push progressively more towards a sovereign state, a federal solution to the EU. And that could take 50 years, but they'll get there on a step-by-step basis. And what is then likely is that the UK is not going to be the only country that decides they don't want to be a part of that. And we already see rumblings in places like in Hungary or in Poland, where people are not at all comfortable with having really only just exited a political union and an economic union with the USSR to be foisted back into a political and economic union with another super state, where they are not perhaps going to have nearly the same recognition that they would have if they were sovereign states. So I think when we think about what's going on in Europe, then the UK has got a rather unique perspective because it represents a banking centre, and Europe doesn't have one. And one of the more important points about the UK is it isn't simply that it's a banking sector, but it's a legal centre, it's a shipping centre, and it's an insurance centre as well. And the global language of business is English. So I think that's a significant point in its favour, that London is going to remain a significant centre for business, regardless of which way the negotiations go. Obviously, Europe has got, I think bureaucratic Europe does not want to give the UK any kind of concessions, but we're starting to see that realpolitik will probably result in a deal that gives the UK perhaps more of what it wants than I think many people envisage at present. And because the UK will have access to the EU and will also have the ability to make trade deals internationally and is a very internationally oriented economy to begin with, then as long as we're in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, then these indices should continue to do well. And when we look at the pound, then it has been subject to really quite acute volatility versus the euro, but we're pretty much towards the lower side of the range versus the euro over the last decade. And when we look at it versus the dollar, well, it's been trending higher for much of the last year and a half, but this is very close to historic lows that were posted back in 1985. So we know that the pound is already quite weak, that a lot of bad news has already been priced in, and that news would have to get significantly worse to justify additional deterioration. Well, when we think about where are we in terms of this medium-term advance, then one of the things that you would tend to expect in the latter stages of a medium-term advance is that cyclical shares tend to do better, because synchronized global economic expansion doesn't happen all the time, but it is of most benefit to shares that tend to have lumpy cash flows. And the commodity sector is certainly one of those, because it sells its products internationally. And when we look at that on a long-term log scale, then we've had a pretty significant rally in 2016 and pretty much a hiatus for most of 2017. But now, as we approach or in the last day of the year, the index is breaking up and out of this most recent range. And that's a significant advance. And what it helps to reiterate is that we're back in a recovery trajectory for the mining sector. Now, it isn't exactly the same mining sector today that was doing particularly well between 2001 and the peak back in 2008, and then the retest of that peak in 2011. That this advance is being driven by the renewable energy sector, and most particularly batteries. That lithium, copper, nickel, and cobalt have been leading this advance. So, for example, when we look at these mining shares, that the big, I think, consolidated miners have tended to, they're most represented by this particular index, but they don't represent where the majority of the growth is coming from, but they do remain on recovery trajectories. When we look at, for example, the cobalt sector, that it is somewhat smaller companies, and Katanga Mining is partially owned by Glencore. That Sherritt International is both a nickel and a cobalt producer, and that is also on a recovery trajectory, a move to new recovery highs this week. Then when we look at the lithium sector, Oro Cambre is one of the only pure plays in this particular index, in this particular sector, and it broke up out to new high ground just in the last 2 months. So these are, I think, rather significant, because when we think about the commodity sector over the last 20 years, people have mostly associated with the growth of Chinese consumers and the Chinese infrastructure sector, which has been driven by demand for iron ore and steel and coal in particular. Well, coal has gone through really quite a profound evolution, and quite a significant number of those companies went bust. So Whitehaven Coal is one of the few survivors and has then rallied rather spectacularly in the last couple of years. And obviously the iron ore sector is heavily influenced by the triumvirate of BHP, Billiton, Rio and Vale. Well, Vale announced in just the last couple of weeks that they're going to be increasing their dividends and that they want to start paying dividends again. Well, when a mining company decides that it wants to become a big dividend payer, having gone through a lengthy period where they invested all of their free cash flow in additional supply, what it suggests when they start paying dividends is that they are going to stop investing in new additional supply. And What that does is improves their cash flow so that they can pay those dividends. But what it also does is restrict supply. And if we get supply inelasticity against an environment where we have rising demand, not least from the evolving battery sector, because obviously Tesla has done all the running in creating a market for electric vehicles. But it is now at the point where there is going to be a lot of copycats. And Tesla has a gigafactory that it went into production with this year and will be expanding next year, but there are at least five more that are under construction, and that is really only the beginning of it. So the market is going to be flooded with batteries in the next 5 years, and that is going to represent a sea change for the global economy. And when we go back and think about the role of the Chinese consumer, where we already have the fact that the Chinese are the biggest car buyers, well, it is the biggest car market that will generally set the tone for what kind of vehicles are produced. And China has got a significant pollution problem. So if they decide to go for electric vehicles, well, then the chances are that it is electric vehicles we're all going to end up driving, because it just doesn't make economic sense to do other than that. Tesla is also another important market because it has been ranging now above this $300 level for the last few months. And the price has already gone up a lot. From 20 to 300 is a really quite a significant advance in the last 7 years. But Tesla doesn't make any money. And when we look back at it's hard to say that its earnings, its losses over the course of the last few years, they've been significant. And the loss that was announced in November of $3.5 billion was its largest. So it's a big question when we look at a double, I think it's a B minus credit rating like Tesla. Then they have gone to the stock market for funding, they've gone to the bond market for funding, and they've gone to regular customers for funding by asking for deposits on their vehicles. What they're in fact doing is raising capital from their consumers. The big question is whether they're going to survive long enough in order to get that supply out to the market. Quite whether Tesla survives or not is largely irrelevant to the evolution of the battery sector. But obviously, it's going to matter a lot to investors in Tesla. The big question for a company like this that has been surviving in large part because of its ability to access very cheap credit would be high yield spreads. And high yield spreads have been inert this year. They have been ranging around 300 basis points, but they have certainly not been trending higher. And it's usually when you start to see high yield spreads beginning to trend higher that stock markets begin to run into trouble. So this, I think, is something I'll be talking about next year in just about every video or audio on Fridays. Because as long as we have high yield spreads that are very low, then the chances are that the ability of companies that depend on access to cheap credit will continue, and that the stock market will be in fine form. When high yield spreads begin to advance, then that is going to represent a headwind. And I think that that is then when we're going to start to see people asking questions about what is the ability of companies to survive in an environment where we just do not have access to abundant credit on an indefinite basis. That is, I think, going to be a big question that will have to get answered. So when we think about it in those terms, then there are some questions out there that will get answered when we have when we have yields starting to push higher. And when we look at the long-term the long-term logarithmic scale chart for bond yields, then we get a very clear indication of just how much yields came down from the peak all the way back in 1980, and also the extent of the volatility that we've had during this bottoming process since really the beginning of 2010. This represents a base formation. Anyone who thinks that the downtrend ended with this failed downside break in 2016 doesn't have a great deal of experience reading charts. This was an incredible acceleration that we saw in 2011. And then we had the counter trend rally, and now we've been in a base formation for 6 years already. And when we look at this log scale chart, then at 3% really does stand out as a really quite a significant level. And if we start to see yields above that level, then that is going to represent the I think clear evidence of base formation completion. One of the things that has contributed to the disinflationary environment that we've had over the last almost 40 years has been globalization. It's been technological innovation. And what that has contributed to is rising living standards for the majority of people. But that is a very amorphous term when we say the majority of people, because obviously there have been clear winners and clear losers. Globalization and the rise of the global consumer have been of particular advantage to emerging markets because they were coming off of such low bases. What that has allowed them to do as is to come up to living standards that were approximating the living standards of people before we had the beginning of globalization. But what it also did was it created a stratification in the living standards of people that gave up their job and their relative position so that you could have globalization. And that is contributing to this rise in populism because the number of people that have had to give up their particular position in terms of their living standards has increased in within the OECD, and most particularly in places like North America and in Europe. And what that is now contributing to is the rise of populist movements. But it isn't simply that you're getting populism or xenophobia or racism, but rather that this is a reaction against the status quo. That the argument that you are getting more for less no longer works when the less that you have is not buying everything that you need. And the evolution of the subscription model, which I think was probably eventually was first pioneered by cigarette companies, that by creating an addiction, then you are creating a cash flow, and then that cash flow can be modeled. Utilities are a subscription model because they have a necessary product that people must have. But what that has done and what has happened in the last decade or so is that an increasingly large number of companies have taken on this subscription model. So you're paying for your utilities, you're paying for your cable, you're paying for your mobile phone, then you're paying for Microsoft, you pay for Amazon, then you are now paying for Adobe, or you're paying for these smaller companies like Blue Apron or Grays, which are selling you ingredients for cooking. And again, this is all on a subscription model. And the quantity of money that is required to subscribe to all these services is quite beyond the reach of an increasingly large number of people, and therefore they have this feeling of inadequacy and discontent with the status quo. And that is what's contributing to this rise in populism. And I think that there is no mistake. This is not a coincidence that this is what we're getting today in terms of the political environment at just the same time that yields are in a base formation. Because the way to ameliorate an unsettled population who are dissatisfied with their standard of living is more money. And how you give people more money is you cut taxes, and that's what they're doing in the USA right now. They're cutting taxes and they're giving people more money in their pockets. The other way is economic growth, and another way is to devalue the currency so that you can stoke economic growth, or you can deregulate, or you can get protectionist, and you can decide that you're not going to import from other countries and hopefully stoke domestic supply. These are all there is not one of those particular solutions that doesn't come with a counterweight argument to why it will not work. And none of them deal with the fact that technological innovation is also one of the contributing factors to deflation. Because when we look at technological innovation and the pace of technological innovation, then it is occurring completely outside of the market cycle. That what is happening today is going to have a transformative effect on the global economy, because we're getting the confluence of some significant trends that are going to both be incredibly growth generative, but are also going to be disinflationary. And I think the first of those is artificial intelligence coupled with big data. Because I think, you know, if we think back to 10 years ago, what we had was computing power, and there wasn't really a lot of digital information around. And today what we have is oodles of digital data. And now the challenge is to come up with enough computing power to tackle it. And coupled with artificial intelligence, that is going to create this massive growth trajectory in the evolution of this particular market. So when we look at it in those terms, then this is a very significant evolution. And what it also means is that this is going to transform the way the global economy works, because computers will be able to answer questions that were previously unanswerable, that we're going to have an evolution in terms of economic potential that was simply unimaginable previously, because of this massive quantity of data that can be compounded. And when we think about that in terms of healthcare, then it becomes truly profound, because the quantity of data simply to create a map of the human brain represents, just for one brain, would represent all of the computing power of Google. And that's just simply for one. When we think about the genetic data that is contained within one person and then is multiplied manifold when one looks at the complexity of the microbiome residing in each of our guts, that each of us is carrying approximately 2.5 pounds of bacteria, fungi and viruses within our digestive tract simply to exist. And each one of those has a unique genetic identity. These are evolving questions that simply couldn't be tackled before and are becoming progressively more accessible. When you think about that in terms of the immuno-oncology sector that basically didn't exist in a commercial form for much of the last few decades, then that is also contributing to the outperformance of the biotechnology sector. And one of the reasons that I look at the biotechnology sector and the commodity sector and the banking sector is because these are all classically cyclical. And the fact that they are all now performing is also helps to add weight to the argument that we're in the latter stages of this cyclical bull market. And we have to then consider how will this cyclical bull market potentially end. And so far, and with the uptick in the pace of the advance, I think the odds are that we're probably going to have an acceleration, that it could evolve into an accelerating market for some of the leading shares and the leading indices, that a significant number of global markets are playing catch up. And one that is really only just beginning to get out of the blocks is Japan. And the Japanese market I find really quite interesting, because they have been trying to create inflation for the longest time. And government bond yields are in a bottoming phase, and Japan is just starting to outperform. The Nikkei has really just cleared the 20,000 level and has broken this long-term progression of lower rally highs. One of the primary consistency characteristics of this decline was that every time it got up to this 20,000 area, it made a new low. And it stopped doing that in 2016. So this is a really quite a profound change. And then when we look at the Japanese banking sector, well, they've had zero interest rates for what must feel like forever. But the index has really only just now broken above 200. And this remains a recovery scenario that is largely unparalleled in terms of global banking, because it has gone nowhere for the better part of 30 years already, and it is really only just beginning to break out now. Japan is the place where, if we're going to see inflation coming back, not simply on a local basis but on a global basis, then Japan is, I think, one of the canaries in the coal mine, that if it starts to return in Japan, then we're going to have inflation everywhere. So I think that 2018 is going to be a very interesting year, because this is potentially a year where we're going to start to see accelerations picking up pace in a number of stock markets. Perhaps we're going to have a recession at some point in 2019, and that will then represent a phenomenal buying opportunity, setting us up for a secular bull market, which will be largely driven by, I think, technology, but most particularly it's going to be artificial intelligence, biotechnology, and revolutions in energy. And not least because all those battery factories are going to come online in the early 2020s. And I think with that, I will leave you for 2017 and look forward to speaking to you all again in 2018.